Hi, this is George Lynch from Doc and Lynch Mob Souls of We, and you're listening to Focus on Metal.
Hey, Metalheads, Scott here.
I'm Richie.
And can you believe it? This is, I believe, episode 592 of this shindig.
Yeah, we'll get to 593 in September, the way it's going at the moment.
Yeah, I know. It's busy. You know, the other thing, I was thinking about it, too, the other day. It's kind of like all of the YouTube video blogs, podcasts, whatever, have almost supplanted a lot of the audio ones. Like, a lot of people do that now, or even people that do audio ones put them up on YouTube as well. And it's kind of a, we're kind of this like almost lone standing, like, yep, we're still doing audio and
dinosaurs.
Yeah, we're dinosaurs. Yeah, I've been dinosaurs for a long time.
Maybe it's because we don't know how to fucking do the other ones.
Now, I could do the other ones. Hell, at work for a while, they were actually, hey, can you do some videos of how you actually do this particular operation on the instrument? And it's like, yeah, no problem. Film it, brought it in here, did all the video editing and everything, and brought it back. And like, holy crap, you can do video editing too? It's like, yeah, you just never asked me before.
I'll get my 9-year-old daughter to show me how to do it. I'm not laughing. You are.
But yeah, it's good to have you down here. And of course, you had one of the things we're featuring this week is a great talk with Mark Ferrari. So that should be good. But before we get into that, how's everything else going?
It's going great.
Yeah.
Just life sucks at the moment.
But, yeah, I hear you.
I'm out of here. I got out of the house.
Hey.
I'm not going to get into it. But
we have the countdown until they find out you're gone, and then they send the posse down after you. Yeah.
The phone's on silent. But,
you know, I know last time we did talk about, you know, my whole wait for my frickin' Scorpions tickets.
Yeah.
And so we flew out there without having tickets in hand. And I think it was like the day or two, because we flew out early, but somewhere along the line, they finally sent an email to go, hey, we fucked up. You're going to need to go to Will Call for your tickets. But even though the day before I was like talking with them being, hey, like I'm shit out of luck at this point. But we got there, figured out where the Will Call place was the first day we got there, and Nikki was like, and they had just opened up and there were a few people that were standing there. She goes, just go over and ask. I'm like, the girl at Ticketmaster was saying there was no way they were going to, I would only get them on the night. She goes, just go ask. Only a couple of people in line. We can wait. Let's go ask. So I'm like, all right. So the girl at the counter, I walked up, I look over the counter and I see this table behind her, nothing but envelopes. And I was like, I can see you got this giant ass table of envelopes. This is going to be like a suck night of everybody picking tickets up for you. She's like, and I'm like, and I got to ask you, I know my tickets are here and I'm probably not on the table behind you, but there's any way I can get my Saturday tickets today, which was I think Wednesday or Thursday. And she was like, well, we usually don't. She goes, at least you understand, like, the crap show that I'm going to deal with. I'm like, yeah. I said, they screwed up.
Now, had Scorp played a show at this stage when you got there?
No. That was, when we got there, that was their first night. We got the second show.
No, I know that, but yeah. I didn't know when the first show was.
So the night we got there was their first show. And so she says, let me call my supervisor. So she called the supervisor, talked to her, and like 10 minutes later, the supervisor came out with my envelope.
16-year-old kid was
in. No, it was probably like in her 50s, older woman.
Okay.
And she gave the, and I said, oh, thank you. And yeah, so sure enough, they had our 3D passes. They also printed out regular Ticketmaster tickets as well and stuff. And I was like, I really appreciate that. That, you know, she said, oh, yeah, no, she goes, no problem. She goes, just don't tell anybody else that you got him early.
Bullshit.
And
tell everybody.
And I was like, yeah, okay. So yeah, they fucked up. They ended up shipping them all to the venue, and everybody had to pick up their tickets. It's just like, ugh. brutal. But it was good. We had, you know, we had that.
They probably charged you a fee for picking up the tickets on top of everything else.
No.
What? I'm shocked.
No.
Ticketmaster.
And yeah, I know. And
we fucked up fee.
It was nice. They had a nice express, you know, VIP entrance as well. So you could skip the line that was going way down the hall, just zip right in. But then, of course, once we got in, like the merch lines, because they were still letting people in, were long. We knocked that out. And then I'll show you a picture, but I lucked out. We got fantastic seats. It was front row. So you had basically the row of seats. We were on the side. And then after a few, there was like some couches with tables that were in the front row. And like some of the folks from Sirius XM and stuff were sitting in on those. And just in front of us was just a pit that might hold, I don't know, 15, 20 people, but they were all below us. And then you had the Eagle ramp that kind of split those two sections in half. So we were just, right in front. It was great. Like, just see over everybody. We could sit the whole time if we felt like it. It was fantastic seats. It was a fantastic show. It really was. And they made massive use of the video screens behind them and stuff. One of the coolest ones was during Mickey D's drum solo, because they're in Vegas. They basically had a giant slot machine behind him. And so he would be doing like a drum thing and the wheels would be spinning. And then he would stop and they would and then they would just like roll into a thing and he'd go into another one. And so it was pretty cool that just all the graphics and stuff that they had going on behind him was great. And then when they did Send Me an Angel, they actually had a big screen with Kotak. I'll show you a picture of that as well. So they had that like dedicated to him, and it was it was an awesome, awesome show. And to hear, like, they didn't do them in order, but to hear every song off of.
Yeah, but they didn't do one song. They didn't do Crossfire, did they?
Yes, they did.
No, I believe there was one song they didn't do on the record.
No, they did them all.
As Long as the Good Times Roll, they do that?
They did the whole album.
Okay. I thought I read somewhere that there was one song they didn't do.
People were thinking maybe they wouldn't do, because it's kind of that more, it's kind of weird. It's that kind of military, like, march thing and with Crossfire. But no, they did everything. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was a great show. So that was good. Crowd was really awesome. People around us were really cool, sociable. Nobody was like,
How did Klaus sound?
Sounded fantastic. Okay. And to hear him, he wasn't moving around too well. Now, granted, he just came out of back surgery. So he would, you know, usually the classic Klaus, right? He's going to take the microphone stand and hold it out to the crowd. And like the first time he did it, it was this very tentative, how's this going to go? And he just kind of leaned it out a little bit. And as the night went on, it went out more. Now, it didn't do the big, you know, over the head and out kind of thing like he would thrust before. So he was still, you know, babying. Which, I don't blame him.
So the human pyramid didn't happen.
No. But what I will say, and it was great because we were so close, is to see him go up and the guy's like barely opening his mouth and he's just hitting notes spot on. And it was just amazing to watch.
Yeah.
He was great. And, you know, everybody was having a really good time. And, great show. Absolutely great show. Yeah, and it's too bad that they weren't, you know, doing tour dates in the U.S. like they're doing over in Europe now.
Yeah, but the Scorpions for years have been one of the consistently good to great live bands.
Yep.
I can't remember reading or hearing about a bad Scorpion show.
Yeah, it's very true.
You know, they always put on a really, really good show. And what, Klaus, what, mid-70s? Rudolph, mid-70s? Yeah. I think Matthias is a few years younger.
Yeah.
Mickey D is probably mid-50s.
Spot on. He was really spot on. And it was, like I said, they did really, really well. And
did they do anything off Rock Believer? Did they do Peacemaker?
I don't remember the whole set, because it was mostly centered around, you know, getting all the Love at First Sting stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of the other big highlighter stuff, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I'm so glad we went and did it.
You're talking Blackout, No One Like You.
Yeah.
Send Me an Angel. They probably didn't do anything from Savage Amusement.
Yeah, like I said, most
so
of
the,
it was,
the recent stuff was primarily they weren't really based done any
on
recent.
You know on that stuff.
They do the zoo, coast to coast.
They did the zoo. They did. I don't remember them doing coast to coast. I don't remember them doing holiday.
Well, you'd probably remember coast to coast because Klaus would have a guitar on. He normally plays the guitar for that.
But he did have it on for something else too.
Okay.
But yeah, I'd have to go back. I don't remember the whole set.
Okay.
It's been
make it real.
It's been a couple of weeks.
Yeah. And you're in Vegas, so you're a bit hazy.
But no, we went out. We just kind of really enjoyed ourselves and just kind of took it in. I mean, she's been there before, so. But yeah, it was good. It was good. And then the other big one that we hit was Priest in MGM Music Hall, which I'd never been to. So
is that the venue. Old? Is that the old House of Blues?
No, the MGM Music Hall they built on like the corner of Fenway.
Oh, so it's further up the same street. Okay, because the House of Blues was a little bit down.
So this like faces like the Pike and stuff. It's like far corner.
Okay, yeah, so, yeah, I know so what you're talking about.
So it's like it's Lansdowne. It's the Lansdowne side of Fenway. But yeah, it's literally the corner. She also decided to do the lounge as well. So the lounge thing let us go in a side door, take an elevator right up to the lounge floor, go right out the elevator, right across. And so they have like a lounge on like the second floor with, you know, your own private bar. They've got a menu for food and the food comes up fast.
Jeez, look at you. Bloody hell.
So it's so we just were able to get dinner.
I remember eating fucking fish and chips and a chipper around the corner of the venue, standing in the pissing rain waiting to go in, and then hoping you won't get fucking trampled on or vomited on.
When you get to this age and you just want to chill. So it was, so, and we were on the second floor too, so we were able to, kick back, have some beers, have some really good smash burgers, and you could access that at any time. Then we're able to just walk out that door, right across the hall, right into our section. And that second floor section had a bar in it in the back as well. So each floor had its own bar, and so we were able. We went down, and I'm like, I'm pretty sure I had aisle seats. So I can see there was like what was supposed to be one and two full. Then there were these two women. And then there was two seats at the end. So then I was like, all right, well, I guess it must go backwards. It doesn't make freaking sense, but I guess one and two must be there.
Must have been good. You're talking for 5 minutes now. We haven't even gotten to the bands yet.
So we're, well, it's just people are shitty. So we sit down in those seats, and then I'm like, it doesn't, like, there's no fucking way this is seats one and two. So she basically took the phone under the seat, so... And then took a picture, and I'm like, yeah, this is seat five. So I just like, I'm like, yeah, fuck this. So I get up, and I just have my phone with my ticket number, and I just go to the two guys that are sitting there, and I go in their face, and I just motion, get the fuck out. And they just were like, and they just weren't even going to fuck with me. They just got up, and they fucking left. And the two women beside them were like, holy shit. So we had a nice aisle seat. Sabaton was good. Crowd was getting into Sabaton.
I don't know much about them.
The coolest thing that they did is that at one point in their set, singer goes over, and there's a kid in the front row, and he goes, how old are you? And kid's 10. And he's like, no way. He goes, you've got the coolest fucking parents ever to bring you to a Sabaton show, right? Talking, the kid's like beaming, right? And, you know, that guy never has his sunglasses off. Takes his sunglasses off and gives them to the kid.
Nice.
And everybody was like, ah, I went friggin' nuts. And like that kid will remember that.
With the singer's son?
That kid will remember that for the rest of his life. That was so cool.
Yeah, it was
that
nice.
He did that. They did a good set. But then, Priest, they did a really good selection. They did new stuff.
Yeah, they're mixed. They've always
stuff.
Mixed it
they
up
really
recently.
Mixed it up nice. Obviously, it's, you know, that venue has a, you know, isn't like an arena size stage, so that, you know, you're seeing him in a smaller stage. But yeah, they still sounded fantastic. Richie was playing spot on, and yeah, top to bottom, just another great show. Mix was a mite muddy, not like Motley Crue muddy, but a little bit muddy, but still good show. And
okay.
Again, nice use of the video screens and all of that stuff that they were doing. And yeah, just a good overall selection of songs. So yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the show I went to. I haven't been to a show for nearly 2 years.
Yeah.
You're going to a show every two fucking weeks.
And we got more coming up.
So I went to see Lynch Mob.
Yeah.
With my 14-year-old son.
Yeah. And they were great last time we saw them, right before the album came out.
Yeah. And so I brought my son to two shows. The first show, he was, I think he was, both of them were pre-COVID.
Yeah.
The first show he ever went to was Lita Ford. And I'd interviewed Lita earlier on that week. And I mentioned to her that I was going with my son. And she said, oh, make sure you let somebody know. And I'll go back, we'll get a picture with you. Yeah. And, you know, I'd say hello. So I said, sure, I'd love to do that. And he was so excited, four songs in, he was asleep in my lap. So he was asleep in my lap. And Bobby Rock did this amazing drum solo.
Uh-huh.
And he was snoring for the whole thing. And the funny thing was, I interviewed Bobby for his book about a year or two later, and yeah. I happened to mention it to him. And Bobby started laughing. He was like, I don't believe it. You know, a big loud drum solo, and he was fast asleep. I said, yeah, he's asleep. So when I was leaving, I was carrying him.
Yeah.
And one of the security guys, or one of the guys said, you know, bring, because the show was over,
right,
bring him up to Lita at the front of the stage, you know, she'd love to meet him. So I'm trying to wake him up.
Uh-huh.
Right, he was having none of it. I was like, fuck. So we ended up going home. Last in line, we ended up meeting the band.
Yeah.
Four songs in, he was asleep. Right in the middle of Andrew Freeman singing Holy Diver. I had to leave with him. And I was, so the first thing I said to him with Lynch Mob, now he's a few years older, you're not fucking falling asleep, because I am not going home early.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been to a fucking show in nearly 2 years.
And this is the Tupelo too.
Yes.
So this isn't like they're on at like 11 o'clock at night. We always talked about this.
8:30.
Yeah, boom. They're on. They're by 11, they're done.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was a support act on, and I can't remember the name of them, but they're actually pretty good. And so Lynch Mob came on and they did a very varied set.
Yeah.
The Lynch Mob material, very heavy on Wicked Sensation.
Yeah.
They did nothing off the self-titled, which pissed me off, because I was hoping they'd do at least Tangled in the Web.
Which they did do when I saw.
Yeah. They did something off Smoke and Mirror. Did one or two songs of Smoke and Mirror.
Which they did when I saw them too. They did a couple off of
the new record, which sounded really good. And what I found really nice was that the new song they did, I think it was the first single on Babylon, my son said, I know that song.
Mm.
So he was able to recognize the new stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
And but you could tell when they were talking to each other, there was a lot of laughing and joking, that they had a set list kind of mapped.
Yeah.
But they just pulled a few things out of the air. Like, they did Lightning Strikes Again.
Yeah.
Off of Under Lock and Key.
Yeah.
And let's just do it.
Yeah,
so
well,
George started playing it.
That's a typical George thing anyways. I think, yeah, because they did The Hunter. When we saw them, it was kind of like, yeah, we're just going into it. Yeah.
Yeah. So they opened with Into the Fire. And, like, they didn't do Tooth and Nail. You know, people were going, oh, he didn't do Tooth and Nail.
Yeah.
But they did Dock and Stuff. Lynch Mob stuff. There was a bit of jamming in between.
Yeah.
Jimmy DeAnda is a fantastic drummer. Just a very tight band. And the Frontiers rep, who the PR person had put me in touch with, was at the show.
Oh, cool.
So we met him after the show. He brought us back into the venue. George was there. I have back for the attack and under lock and key. I had it signed by Mick, Jeff and Don.
Yep.
So I was able to get George to sign him now. So now my vinyl copies have signed by all four.
Nice.
And my son met George, met the singer. Singer was a really nice guy, yeah. Bass player. Jimmy wasn't there.
Yeah.
But we must have talked to him for like 10 minutes. But yeah. there was two guys there and they just hugged George for the whole time. And all I was able to do was say hello to George and introduce him to my son. And I never really got a fucking chance to say anything else to him. But I was able to talk to the singer.
Yeah.
And I talked a fair bit to the PR Frontiers guy.
Uh-huh.
So I was a bit pissed at that because the fucking guy just kept fucking hogging George and talking to him.
Yeah.
And I didn't get any photos.
Oh, that's bad.
Well, I didn't, you know, I didn't ask.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were just... good show, good band.
Yeah, it's a good band.
Solid lineup.
It's a little bittersweet, too, because, you know, this is, they'll be doing this tour, and they'll be doing this right up until the Monsters of Rock cruise, and then that Monsters of Rock cruise is supposed to be their last show.
It was supposed to be.
You know?
Heard that before.
But this, yeah, it's a really good lineup that seems to be gelling musically
He's a good singer.
He is.
He's very good.
He is.
I actually... he came across live to me better than I thought he would.
Even singing
the older stuff.
He was really confident. And yeah, I mean, to walk out and...
he's only a tiny guy.
Yeah, he is. And you know, because you know that all these other people are looking, being like, who the fuck is this guy, right? And he just went and just nailed it. And, you know, took no prisoners. Did a great job.
It seems to me that George, he's having a lot of fun now with it.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's talking about this being the end. And he just wants to go and play, have fun on stage.
Yeah.
Because he's 70 now. You know, he's seen it all, still churning out a lot of music. But he just comes across on stage now like... yeah, I'm just enjoying it now. Right. It's nearly over, and
yeah,
you know
what it reminded me a lot of, just the overall feeling of the band was back when I saw them on that original Wicked Sensation tour, where again they were loose, having fun, and you know not having a ton of material to draw from like they do now from you know from being pure Lynch Mob, but still. Just went out and had a lot of fun with it. You could tell they were just enjoying doing it. And I got that feeling again when I saw them.
There was a couple of people that were giving out that he doesn't play the solos the same.
So what?
That's what they were giving out about. They wanted to hear that solo from that record played that way.
Then go listen to the album.
Yeah, but he hasn't played the solos like that in years anyway.
Right.
Like some of the solos he did, or a lot of the parts in it were unrecognizable. He just went off somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you got to realize, too, is that, you know, I'm sure not every solo, but there's a lot of solos that get comped. You know, hey, do this, do it. Now do it again. Now do it again. Now do it again. And then the producer's back there going, okay, I like this phrase. I like this phrase. I like this phrase. And he comps his solo together. And, okay, that's what goes out on the record because that's what served the song on the record. And then George is going to do whatever he wants to do live. He's a capable guitarist.
The other thing I don't recall him doing for the whole gig is changing the guitar. Now, you go to any of these like hard rock shows where the guy is a quote-unquote guitar hero.
Yeah.
There's about five or six guitar changes.
Well, for some of them, because George did change guitars when we saw them, was that if you have a key change, so there's a tuning change, and rather than be like, okay, well, we're going to let everybody watch you retune your guitar, it's easier to just go and hand it in the other tuning.
But I don't recall him changing his guitar at all.
That's interesting.
Yeah. He just played the whole set with the same guitar, unless he did a real sleight of hand. But I don't recall him doing it. But
yeah.
I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah.
So what's the next show for you?
I want to say it's the Sammy one.
I'm thinking of going to that. Do you know who's announced the show? I think I'm going to definitely go. Is Vandenberg. Agent Vandenberg is playing the Tupelo. I've never seen him.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's the next one.
You're going to go see Accept and KK's Priest? I think it's probably sold out, though.
Probably sold out. I actually, you know, when I went to Satriani, too, that was another one that was in April.
See? Oh,
that was a great show.
Actually, you've seen Joe about 37 times.
Yeah, this was good. This was good. And the reason I just, because I said Sammy is obviously he's playing with Sammy. But also for that show, the keyboard player and second guitarist he was using, he's, because I saw some rehearsal pictures and I was like, oh, that's Joe's dude. So doing keyboards and stuff. So I was like, okay. So that's, so looking forward to that. It'll be a bitch of a day because I got a, that's the last day of, we've got like a week booked at a campsite and it'll be like hauling the camper home, basically parking it and then screaming to Mansfield like all on the same day. So that'll be, yeah, then the next day going back and being like, okay, now we can like unpack and do everything else.
Yeah. I might go to the Hagar show. I've seen Sammy do a show similar to the one he's going to do with a lot of Van Halen stuff. He's probably going to do a lot more Van Halen stuff than he did at that show. But
well, yeah, that's the plan. That's why he was.
Yeah,
because it's not a Sammy in the Circle show. Because we saw our Sammy in the Circle show last summer, which was great, and he did a couple of Van Halen things on that. But there was also he was doing Circle songs, he was doing Sammy Hagar stuff.
Montrose.
But this one has really been advertised as, you know, we're celebrating
Van Halen.
Van Halen stuff that I did, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's only four records. Although there's a lot of good shit in those four records. You
know, there's a lot of stuff that happened there, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe I got an email a couple of weeks ago that, you know, Live Nation or whoever, they'll churn out these $25 offers.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the shows on offer. But I think with the amount of shows that are on at the moment, and some of them some of the arena shows are being cancelled by certain acts. Mm. I think Jennifer Lopez is one of them.
I'm sad.
She's cancelled the whole tour.
Oh, it's terrible.
Rumored to be because of ticket sales, but of course that's never the official reason given.
But yeah, no, I got that. Those, I think that one and then Metallica, I think, are the next two big ones.
Where are they? Foxborough?
Foxborough, yeah.
Last time I saw Metallica was in Dublin. It would have been before I moved here. I don't know, these big enormo domes now seeing a band.
Yeah, but they've sized the show appropriately for that too.
Are you going to both shows?
No, we're going to go
It's not like you.
I've got tickets. I have tickets for both.
Of course you do.
But honestly, who would want to deal with, even though it's not 2 days in a row, but 2 days in a weekend, deal with fucking Foxborough.
Yeah, if anybody doesn't know, that's the New England Patriots football stadium, and it's in the middle of fucking nowhere.
I mean, as it is, we've got a campsite already booked for that weekend. So we'll pull in the day of the show, be able to just go down the street to the show, basically, and go back.
Yeah.
And
there's
then,
fuck all out there. There's the stadium, there's a shopping area, and then when the footballer is not on, there's fucking nobody.
It's out there. But yeah, so I'll do the. We're gonna do the Pantera one, and then we'll do. I'm gonna sell the second day to my buddy Jeff.
Yeah,
because when I bought them, I bought those super early, like the first day they went, and they were only selling both day tickets.
Yeah, but you're in the fan club and shit, so you should get them really early.
Which is why I got them really early.
Yeah.
But you couldn't get, like, you couldn't pick a day. You had to buy both days. So it's like, okay. And there's no way to, you know, to split them apart. But yeah, so I'll end up doing that. My buddy Jeff will go on the Sunday. We'll do the Friday.
Okay.
We got that. And then if his voice stays together, the next thing after that will be there.
When are you going on the Friday? Is that what you said? Yeah, I hope they play all of St. Anger on the Friday.
Great. Complete with
Lulu.
Oh, fuck me. Oh, I don't think they've done any of that one live. The reason for that.
I am a table.
And we'll see what else fills in. I'm sure there'll be some other stuff. We've kind of been backing off on them a little bit.
There's too many shows.
And I mean, yeah, the fact that we do the VIP for Stained and then we turn around and don't go to the concert, we go to Queensryche and Armored Saint.
Good call.
It was
That's a good call.
It was, you know, just so yeah, we've kind of I think, backed off a little bit on some of them just because, yeah, there's just so many. And April was brutal. It was just seemed like it was something every week.
Well, everybody wants to be first. Like, once it hits February at the latest, all the news websites are blank name band announced tour, blank name band announced tour, blank name. They're everywhere. The bands are everywhere and they're out all the fucking time. Yep. This is the only way they can make money.
Yeah.
Yep. And the competition is fierce.
Yeah. So getting back to our guest this week.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it's been a couple weeks since you actually talked to Mark. But what was funny was, so you were talking to him and I had totally forgotten he was from Lawrence, which is just down the road from here.
I didn't know he was from there at all.
And then I was thinking Rob Zombie was too, but he's not. He's another town over. He was from Haverhill.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Mark mentioned to you Mr. C's. And I could tell that you like...
I had no clue.
So this is before... So Mr. C's, we could walk to where Mr. C's used to be from here.
What
Mr. C's was the biggest freaking rock club in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
So, you know where the bus station is?
Yeah.
And there's the big hill?
Yeah.
Mr. C sat on top of that hill.
Oh, okay.
They cut some of it away. It used to be called the Commodore Club way back in the 20s or 30s or whatever. But it was, when it got to, 70s, 80s, it was Mr. C's Rock Palace. And it was still... like the biggest rock club in Massachusetts. So I've talked to Carmine Appice about that because he was like, holy shit, you know Mr. C's? It was like, yeah, I remember playing there underage. I could tell. I'm like, I bet Richie doesn't even realize that we're basically living in the shadows of where that used to be.
I don't know if you noticed, but I'm not from here.
Well, I just didn't know if you heard about it before or anything like that. I don't even know. I know at one point you could still see the steps on the side of the hill going up. I don't know if they're still there or not. But yeah, but it was just literally right there. Yeah, huge. Big giant ass horseshoe bar in there.
All the bands came through?
Oh, yeah. I believe that Cactus played there either the night before they played with Zeppelin at the Tea Party or after.
Aerosmith must have played there.
Yeah, all those bands. They would have been, by the time Extreme was coming up, that was gone.
Yeah. Oh, so you're talking early 80s, like, it was shut down.
Early 80s,
the 70s.
Yeah, it was, by that time, that was gone. Cars probably did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, because I said, it was like, at one point in time, this area was blanketed with clubs to play. And.
Not like that anymore.
Not anymore. No, but you had the clubs in Drake by the lake, and then you slowly had them that were going down. So where like that new market basket is on the boulevard.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
So that was where K's was, which was a big club. And actually, I saw when they were digging up for that, I was like, I told my buddy John, I'm like, hey, I think they just pulled up some of the foundation of K's.
You work next door to that, don't you?
Pretty close to it, yeah. And then K's 2 was downtown here, and you had the Foxtail. I mean, there were the Cell Block. There were so many clubs to play in this area. And then up in, same thing in Billerica, there was a whole bunch of clubs and stuff in Billerica. I was like, there was a ton of places you could play over here. So you were always getting bands coming through here. Not anymore. You wouldn't know it.
It's interesting because, they all talk about all the club scene that was in like LA and New York.
Yeah.
But with Boston, it doesn't really get talked about a lot at all, so many clubs.
You know what it does? So it's interesting because Boston gets talked about when it concerns more of the like the punk kind of new wave type. So like Mission of Burma, stuff like that. Then you kind of get a recognition of, guys like Willie Loco Alexander and things like that. And people go, oh, yeah, Boston. But a lot of the hard rock stuff from around here, it's for some reason, it's like, oh, no, it never happened. But, it was – the other part of it, too, was that when those clubs were all out there, is the drinking age was 18.
Right, so where did the police play? Did they play around here then in the late 70s?
They probably played like Mr. C's. Yeah. I'd have to look, but yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Definitely the Channel.
Yeah.
Actually, see, I got a Channel Frisbee over there.
The Channel, what, that was that closed in the early 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were one of the last bands booked.
Yeah. I think White Lion's last show was at the Channel.
Might be. That was also
on
where
the main attraction tour.
Some of Metallica's amps got stolen.
That's right.
That's where
that was in the mid 80s, wasn't it?
Amps went into the canal. that was a great club though. That was a really, really awesome club to play. And at a parking lot, which for Boston was unheard of, but it had a big fucking parking lot.
Wow. So yeah. What's there now?
A post office.
Okay, I was going to say apartments, because that seems to be where all the venues are now.
At some point, because that's South Boston, it probably will be apartments.
Yeah, but for millions and millions of dollars.
It was a Channel forever, and then it was a strip bar, and then, yeah, it got taken over by the Postal Service. Because, I mean, it's a good property. I said huge parking lot and shit, too. So wow. So I just, you know, when Mark said that, I was like, I got to tell Richie about that, because was a huge part of this area and for years, because like people, even like Benny Goodman and shit played there when it was like the Commodore Ballroom.
Can I ask you a question about Mark Ferrari?
Yeah.
Right. How well regarded and covered was he in the mid to late 80s? Because you hear all these names of other guitar players, uh-huh. and he had his own band, Ferrari, that went into Cold Sweat. So he obviously had a name to be able to do it. But yeah. I don't recall him getting anywhere near the same coverage that a lot of the other guys did.
So he did. It was mostly with Keel. And it was mostly in things like Guitar for the Practicing Musician.
Is it because Keel didn't break that he didn't get the recognition? Recognition might be the wrong word. The coverage might be a better word.
Yeah, so you've got, because you got to figure that guitar press covers things differently than, say, you know, the Hit Parade or something like that, right? So if you've got a marquee like, you know, Bon Jovi, yeah, okay, Richie Sambora gets all kinds of coverage, right? But when you get a band like Rough Cut, so Amber Derrick would get coverage in guitar magazines as being a really great guitar player, but you wouldn't see, you know, Rough Cut plastered everywhere. So a similar thing with Keel.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're very similar thing for that. And there was a lot of bands like that had really good players. And, you know, Mark was known as being a really good fluid player, and they would do transcriptions of Keel stuff. And granted, too, that the Keel stuff was more... there wasn't a focus on the guitar playing either. There was that focus on Mark's voice, and there was the focus on like the gang vocals and all of like the production values and things like that. I think if it had been more of a rough and ready type of recording, I think maybe there would have been a little bit more recognition for him. I don't know. But from the guitarist perspective, yeah, people knew who Mark Ferrari was.
Okay. But he wasn't flashy. He wasn't a flashy player.
No. He served the song, and just kind of fit in there. But if you were a guitar player, you could listen to him and go, "Shit, that's good." So kind of like Andy Timmons, right? So you would think about.
He's a great fucking player,
right? But he's not really known as being outside of guitar circles.
Yeah,
most people don't go, "Oh fuck, Andy Timmons, shit hot player," right? They're more like, it's that ballad band, right? And so you think, just a guitar player, right? Because now they got a lot of coverage, but he was never recognized in the whole as a great player. But if you really are a music fan like you, when you listen and go, shit, not, you know, and it isn't even just who's fastest or anything like that, because you look at somebody like Mark Kendall, right? Granted, Great White got huge coverage, but Mark Kendall, he wasn't like a blazing guitar player. But what he could play, and still plays, is very tasty and well put together. Yeah. And you're like, oh, shit, I wish I thought of playing that. And so you kind of look at him from that perspective and go, that's a great guitar player. And Mark was the same thing, as you just listen to it and it's tasteful, it fits, it doesn't go overboard, and he just always seems to be able to nail it.
Yeah. So I enjoy talking to him. Just nice guy. Good to know he's in the next town over.
Yeah, I had forgotten about it. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. But yeah, because there was a lot of places to buy gear around here before. And yeah, it's like a whole freaking step change now. But it was, you know, it was great. I was enthused that you had him on, because he's, you know, he's kind of been this guy that went from the Kiel stuff, the Ferrari, right? And then obviously you were talking to him for the Cold Sweat stuff. I think we touched a little bit on the Cold Sweat stuff when you talked to Chris McLaren.
I did.
Too,
I
which,
got
believe
into
it
that.
Or not, that was a year ago.
No way.
That was a year ago. June of 2023.
Time flies and your life sucks.
Believe it or not. I couldn't believe it, because I was like, you know, knowing we were going to talk about Mark and Cold Sweat tonight, I was like, when did we talk to Chris? And it was like, it's like episode 271 or something. But it was, yeah, June of last year. I was like, holy shit.
Wow.
Because it just seems like yesterday I mixed the episode.
Yeah. Well, the point of having him on was to talk about Saigon Kick.
Yeah. Right. But you did touch on Cold Sweat.
I did in the end. Yeah. I did in the end.
And so.
Which helped me actually talking to Mark, because I had
right.
stuff that I wanted to ask Mark about what Chris told me.
So it was good. And I liked. You know, Mark is always this consummate music businessman. And, I mean, you see this because he appeared in Bob's Band versus Brand documentary. He was in that a lot. Because he does have a lot of industry savvy. So
yeah, what fascinated me about him, and I got into it in the interview, was he was on board early on with the soundtrack stuff.
Yep.
Which I wasn't really... I'd read about it, but I didn't know how he'd got into it and how well he'd done with that.
But not just soundtracks, but it's also licensable music.
Yeah.
Now that's his real thing, was just being able to make stuff and go, yeah, I'll license that for that. I'll license it to you for that. I'll license it. So yeah.
I think Brad Gillis does that too.
Maybe.
I think he does some music for ESPN and other avenues like that.
But yeah, I mean, he's a smart guy, and I'm glad you did go into, you know, some of that stuff with him. So it's kind of funny because you had Ron Young talking about it last episode. Mark will talk about it here as well. So some, you know, two guys that definitely have some cautionary tales about the industry. And, you know, I think I agree that the whole idea that Cold Sweat, I think they recorded it or started doing stuff in 88, right? And it doesn't come out until 90.
Yeah, but Oney bailed.
No, yeah. Imagine.
Oney Logan bailed.
Imagine
on
that.
Just as they were getting ready to sign a record deal.
Yeah. But it's still, you know, that whole classic, they've got this thing, they've got a good sound, they get all that together, and by the time that this album comes out, it's this, I can't remember who we were talking to. Might have been Kendall. That he talks about walking into the label, where they used to have the big picture of them behind the receptionist, and they go on.
One of the guys in,
like,
Warrant.
And it, oh, that's
Alice
what it was.
Chains had, yeah.
And Alice, they had the Alice Chains thing up.
It was one of the guys from Warrant.
That's right. It was from Warrant. And that's kind of that was in my brain when I was listening to Mark talk as well, that they get this far along, and then, like, it's basically the plug gets pulled.
They have no singer. They have to audition a million singers. Eventually they get a singer.
Yeah.
Now you're talking 91. Album comes out.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of bands brought out albums around then.
Yeah.
And someone to bring up a name of a band, like Heaven's Edge.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember them. But within a year, they were all gone.
Which is where the bass player from Lynch Mob came from. but you think about it, right? I mean, here's a band, obviously good, talented players, right? All come from different bands as well. Thing comes out in 91, and like, they can't pay people to buy it. It's almost the same story of Rat comes back from Japan, and was it Detonator? I think it was Detonator.
Yeah.
And it's like DOA, same thing. And like,
White Line.
The songs are still good.
We already spoke about White Line, Main Attraction.
And it's just like finicky, like, oh, new thing. And yeah, it's a shame. And so I think this is a band that probably had some really good promise and, yeah, just buried right at the beginning.
Yeah, because White Lion, I think they brought out a main attraction. I think it was April, May 91. Might have been a little bit before. And they toured Europe.
Yeah.
Came back here in September. They were done.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah. It's crazy. It sucks. But it was good to have Mark on and, you know, kind of get the word out about what they're doing with Cold Sweat and stuff. So, yeah, you know, hey, I mean, I don't think they're going to go touring anytime soon or anything, but yeah, it was a good guy to have on and talk about everything that went on.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So what do you say we roll the conversation with Mark Ferrari?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right.
Richie?
Yeah, Mark, how you doing?
I'm all good in the hood, man.
So where are you? Where are you?
I am in Southern California.
Okay, enjoying the weather.
Yeah, where are you?
I am just outside of Boston, Massachusetts.
Well, that's where I moved to California from. Where are you?
I live in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Well, I used to live in Lawrence, so I'm very familiar with Lowell.
Next town over.
Next town over, yeah. There used to be a great club there called Mr. C's Rock Palace. I don't know if it's there anymore. It was, you know, 40 years ago. But it's probably not there anymore. It's probably something else that they tore down. But that was a pretty cool concert venue.
Okay, nice, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what made you move?
Well, we were starving, and we figured if we were going to be starving, we might as well be starving where it was warmer and where the girls were and where all the great music was coming from. That was our line of thinking back then. So
okay.
Yeah.
So I got you on. We're going to talk about the Cold Sweat, the new release. But one of the questions I've been asking all the guitar players: how many guitars do you have in your house?
Well, I've pared down quite a lot from the day. I think I have about five left.
Okay.
I think I have three electrics, acoustic, and a classical right now. So, yeah, I've kind of whittled it down to, you know, just the bare minimum, you know, because I'm not touring anymore, and you know, the live shows are few and far in between. So I just kind of got it down to the nitty gritty.
What was the most you had then, back in the day?
Oh, I think at the most I probably had a dozen, you know.
That's not that many compared to some of the guys I've spoken to.
That's right. You know, some guys literally have, you know, dozens, you know. But I probably even less than that. I think maybe eight to ten, you know, at the most.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any of the guitars that you recorded a Cold Sweat record with?
Well, of course, yeah. My 1968 Gibson Les Paul has been on every recording that I've done, and I know I used that guitar. Was a workhorse for me back in the day when we recorded the Cold Sweat album in 1989, 1990. The other guitars, sadly, I don't have anymore. I've sold a few off, and you know, I think one or two were stolen. So, but I know the 68 Les Paul was used on the Cold Sweat record quite a lot.
Mm. And one of the questions I also asked the guitar players, and I normally get the answer I expect, which is no. Do you have the first guitar you ever owned?
Well, in my case, I do.
Yes, I do.
My parents bought me this cheap little three-quarter size acoustic guitar when I was 8 years old, and I still have it.
So fantastic!
It's made by a company called Stella. I don't even know if they exist anymore. So, you know, I would have had that in 1970 or 1971. So, yeah, I've got my first guitar.
Nice.
Yeah.
I had Chris McLernan on last year, and we spoke about the Canal project he was doing. And it was basically his love of Tin Lizzy. And as a guitar player, Mark, how big an influence were they on you?
Oh. tremendously. I mean, you know, they were one of the foundations of, you know, my playing, you know. And I'm very blessed to call Scott Gorham an acquaintance. You know, we've crossed paths a couple of times, and I'm actually friendly with John Sykes, too. You know, he texts me and calls me once in a while, and the other fellow that was a replacement guitar player, Damon Johnson, was in Thin Lizzy for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, but, you know, Thin Lizzy, huge influence. Now, if you listen, you know, to my playing, dual harmony solos are really, you know, that's one of my trademarks, you know, is the dual harmony, the harmonification of solos, you know. And certainly Cold Sweat was influenced, you know, the name Cold Sweat, of course, came from the song, you yeah. know, the Thin Lizzy song. And you know, between Thin Lizzy and Michael Schenker, that's where I have my and a little bit of Tom Scholz from Boston. You know, a lot of his solos were harmonized too. You know, that's where I got it from. But you know, Thin Lizzy, huge influence on me.
Mm.
Just yeah, of course.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the unreleased studio tracks that are on this new release. When were they recorded?
Those would have been recorded in late 1990 or early 91. We came off the road in late 1990, late fall, and I remember, you know, of course we're rolling the clock back here almost a third of a century, it's not
yeah,
more,
yeah.
You know. I remember that we started writing pretty quickly, and some of those may have been recorded in late 90 and some of them early 91.
Okay, so none of them were like unreleased tracks recorded for the debut.
No, that is correct. We didn't have any leftover tracks that we recorded for the album.
Hmm.
Everything that we recorded for the album made the album.
Now,
so
here's the thing with the unreleased tracks, right? And it's come out with a lot of bands over the years that the album comes out, it doesn't do as well, and maybe they get dropped by the label or they have other circumstances surrounding that. And then they record these demos and they shop it and they don't get a record deal. Is that a similar situation to these four songs?
That's the exact situation.
Okay.
That's the exact situation with us. Now, don't forget, you know, 1991 was a kind of a pivotal year. That's the year that the Nirvana album came out and a few of those other you know, grunge bands that followed. You know, by 1991, certainly the climate had shifted away from commercial hard rock. You know, the commercial hard rock guys had their day in the sun for the better part of a decade. You know, I guess you can say it started in 1983. You know, with Quiet Riot, they were the first LA band to have a number one album. You know, even before Van Halen. So, and you know, the commercial hard rock heyday was between like 83 and 90, you know. Certainly by 1991, when these demos were recorded, it was a kind of a different ball game for sure.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is, you know, the stories back then were a lot of these bands, when they got dropped, they were done. And over the years, it's come out that actually they weren't done, that they tried to continue. Like, I give you one example, the band Badlands. Their Dusk album is demos that they tried to shop after their second album. And then recently, Jamie St. James from Black and Blue, he released demos with Tommy Thayer that they did after they were dropped by Geffen. So you're not the only band that did this, but I think back in the day, everybody thought that none of the bands did this, that they just finished.
Well, I think in our case, we felt we were finished, you know, because, again, we made the rounds. There were no takers, you know, not even doing an independent release, you know, or a smaller label. And so, I think in our case, Cold Sweat went on without me. They rebranded as Sweat and Bullets. I don't know if you knew that or not, but they brought in another guitar player and they rebranded as Sweat and Bullets. So, you know, maybe that was a good thing to do at the time. You know, everybody was kind of, you know, not knowing what was going on, you know, and how do we react to this changing environment? You know, some folks decided to distance themselves from their commercial hard rock roots and other folks didn't. But in the case of Cold Sweat, I think we realized that, you know, we had run its course, unfortunately, you know, and it was a, you know, we only had that one lap around the track with the one album and the one touring cycle, you know.
Mark, how did you feel about it looking back now? Were you motivated to go somewhere else with your career? Like some people, they ended up, you know, some people might go into, they went into computers or they went into production or something like that.
That's kind of exactly what happened with me too. I don't know if you know the rest of my story.
But, yeah, I know. I know some of it, but I'm just trying to ask you. At that time, did you know what you wanted to do, or was music the playing the guitar you thought was going to be the be all and end all for the rest of your life?
I wish I had a longer playing career, both with Keel and Cold Sweat, but it wasn't meant to be, you know. But what it did do for me is it forced me to figure something out. And in my case, that thing was providing music for TV shows and films. Back in the early 90s, this was just a burgeoning industry. It was just starting to come into play. You know, I happened to be at the right place at the right time where all these TV shows started using popular music back in the early 90s, and there was not a music library out there that had material that sounded like it could have been from major label bands. So that was my aha moment where, you know what, you know, I don't have to try to get a record deal here. I don't have to, you know, wear silly clothes. I don't have to go on the road. You know, I can provide music, you know, for TV shows and films and video games. And I did very well with that. I developed a business that I sold to Universal in 2007. So,
Now, one of the things you find over the years as well is that when it came to musicians from your era, when it hit the 90s, it was very hard to sell yourself, that when people found out what era you came from, they were like, oh, no, we don't want nothing to do with anyone from that era. When you started shopping yourself to do the soundtrack stuff, you didn't get that same resistance, did you?
No. As a matter of fact, being a major label recording artist, you know, actually helped me. You know, it added a degree of credibility. You know, and a lot of the folks in the studios knew who I was. So it helped me get in the door with some of these people. It was just the opposite. It was helpful to have been in Circus Magazine's Best New Band 1985 with Keel, you know, and having the videos and everything else. So it was a door opener for me.
Can you remember a time then after that where it was the pivotal moment for you that you knew, yeah, this is actually going to really work for me?
Well, yeah, when I started getting checks from the studios and royalty checks from ASCAP and BMI, it was an eye opener, you know, and I was starting to make some decent money, you know, on the stuff. And, you know, I was hoping eventually maybe musical climate would change. It would allow me to put another band together. Actually, I did have another band called Medicine Wheel, which did three independent releases from 1994 to 1998. But we played very, very rarely with that band. But it still allowed me to have my, you know, creative yayas, you know, while I was doing all the work for the studios, you know.
And I'm sure you probably would have had many musicians from that era, when you started doing well, maybe hitting you up saying, how do you do this?
Well, absolutely. And I was able to hire a lot of my friends with those early recordings. Yeah. You mentioned Tommy Thayer. Tommy and I wrote a lot of songs together. We were actually roommates for a while.
Okay.
And, you know, guys like Robin McCauley and Steve Plunkett and, you know, even Mark Slaughter and the guys from King's X, you know, I hired these guys to write some of the music that I was doing for the studio. So I was able to throw a little work to my friends at the same time.
Nice.
It was great.
Nice.
Yeah.
I want to switch over to the live tracks that are on the Unburied Alive release. And some of them are from the Super Rock Festival in Germany. How much touring did you do in Europe with Cold Sweat?
Well, unfortunately, we only did the two gigs. We did the Monsters of Rock in Mannheim, and we did a gig at the Borderline Club in London. That was the only touring we did in Europe. We did a fair amount of touring in the States. I remember, of course, we did the Dio, one of the legs of the Dio tour, Lock Up the Wolves, mm-hmm. it was, in 1990. But we also did tours with bands like the Sleazebees and Sabotage and Child's Play. I mean, they weren't huge bands at the time. They were kind of breakout bands like ourselves. But we did a fair amount of touring that summer of 1990. Mm. But as far as Europe goes, it was only those two gigs.
Did you get a chance after your set to watch the other bands at the Mannheim show? Because I think it was Whitesnake and Aerosmith, Poison.
Vixen. Yeah, of course, yes. I always loved, and still, you know, I'm still a fanboy myself, you know. I love going on these cruises because get to watch some of my favorite bands. But yes, I remember, you know, Aerosmith, of course, a huge influence on me. And, of course, we watched the Dio set. And, you know, Whitesnake, I was friends with Steve Vai at the time. And, I'm probably on the side for the whole show.
Okay, nice. Because one of the things Chris McLaren told me was when you guys went out with Dio, he watched a lot of the Dio shows. He made it a point to watch Ronnie and to watch Rowan.
Yeah. Well, we you know, look, I'm always a fan of Ronnie Dio's. You know, don't forget, he also opened up for Dio. So I got to do two tours with Ronnie in two different bands in two different eras. Keel opened up, that was our big European tour, opening up for Dio in 1986. I think that was the Sacred Heart tour. And then 4 years later, you know, I get to open up for Ronnie again with Cold Sweat. So I was always watching Ronnie. He was Mr. Consistency.
Mm. What's the best piece of advice he ever gave you?
Well, first of all, he always strove for perfection. I remember that. We were doing our demos with him. He was really good about, you know, bringing out the best in our musical abilities. And, you know, he's such a humble guy. I think, you know, not that any of us had big, big heads on our shoulders, but to see him interact with his fans and how much he cared for his fans, that was a real, that was a lesson in humility, let's put it that way.
Mm. Of course, you would have seen Rowan grow up with that band, but I think he was 17 at the time.
That's right.
Did you talk a lot to Rowan? Was he a shy guy? Did he want to learn the ropes? What sort of person was he then?
I remember him being a fun guy. By the way, I just saw Rowan about a month ago at my birthday party because he lives out in Vegas.
Nice.
And he roomed with Eric Gammons from Cold Sweat, who was only a year older than him, maybe 2 years. I think Eric was 20 and Rowan was 17 when they were living together. But they were roommates. So, you know, both bands had really young guitar players. But I remember Rowan being a real sweet guy. You know, he was just wide-eyed and taking everything in and pretty humble guy.
Mm. Now, one of the other things Chris told me was there was a lot of upheaval in the Dio camp, and you guys were kind of rehearsing in the same spaces as they were. What are your memories of that? Because one of the things I've read in the books is that Rowan was one of the guitarists, but another guitarist that was mentioned at the time was Gary Hoey. And I'm not sure what other guitar players came in or out. Do you remember any of the guys that came in or out at the time?
No, I wasn't there during their audition process. So I don't even recall hearing that Gary Hoey was in the mix with things. But Gary's a great player. But no, I mean, I don't recall that at all. Okay. You know, but again, I didn't attend any of the rehearsals.
You knew Ronnie pretty well and Wendy as well. Were you half expecting a call to audition for Dio?
No.
Not at all?
No, because I'm the wrong kind of player, man. I am not the blazer guy that, you know, that they need. You know, I'm not that flash player. You know, I'm a rootsy blues bass player. You know, my roots are like Pat Travers and Johnny Winters and Ace Frehley, Jimmy Page, Robin Trower, you know. So no, I was the wrong type of player for them. And
was there a lot of bands back then, Mark, that were looking for you to play, or even when you were in Kiel or Cold Sweat, they were like, yeah, Mark Ferrari, he'd fit in here. Might be a higher profile band. I'm just asking the question.
If there was, they certainly didn't do a good job in reaching out to me. You know, I don't recall being courted by anybody. You know, but a little funny story. I did audition for Lita Ford's band way back after the first Kiel show. By the way, it was the anniversary of a first Kiel show 40 years ago on Sunday.
Wow.
And yeah, that was. and then Ron announced he was getting the gig in Black Sabbath, and we all were scrambling to do stuff. And I auditioned for Lita Ford, and I felt I was good enough to be in her band, but she wanted someone that could also play keyboards. And okay. I didn't play keyboards.
What songs did you play at the audition? Can you remember?
Oh, God, I don't remember. It was so long ago.
Yeah.
Probably just whatever hits she had at the time, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, that would have been literally 40 years ago this month.
Yeah, yeah. I want to switch over to producers that you've worked with back in the day. So I want to know what the main differences are between the way Gene produces, Michael Wagner produces, and Kevin Beamish produces.
Well, there are subtle differences. You know, Gene is the only musician out of the three. So there's certain language musicians have with each other that are easier to decipher. Gene really did let us, especially on the second record, kind of steer the ship a little bit more. You know, on The Right to Rock, he was more hands-on and did come up with some good production ideas and arrangement ideas. Michael Wagner, of course, he's really known for being a techie guy, and our album was actually one of the first albums that was recorded digitally.
Wow.
Back in 1986 is when we started working on that album, and that's when digital recording just started coming into play. Prior to that, everything was, you know, 2-inch tape. Mm-hmm. So Michael certainly had a he had a technical advantage that Gene didn't have. And Kevin was a good balance between the two of them. He was a little of both. And Kevin, I think the Cold Sweat album, in retrospect, maybe it was a little too slick. You know, if you heard some of the demos for that album, they were definitely more raw. And so that's the influence of the other guys too. You know, Chris in particular. You know, he's definitely, he was into Queen. You know, he was a big Queen guy. So a lot of our songs had real heavy guitar parts to vocal parts to it.
Okay.
So yeah,
Mark, were you the guy that kept asking Michael, Gene, and Kevin Beamish, why do you want me to do this? How do you capture that sound? Why is the microphone here? Or were you just the guy that just, okay,
no,
and played?
I didn't question the technical, the technical part of things. I didn't question what microphone are you using to mic my cabinet, and you know, where are you placing it. I figured this is why we hire these guys. You know, in the case of Kevin and Michael, we had more of a choice of what producers we wanted to work with, whereas Gene was kind of. Gene was like, with Gold Mountain, he was like, we will sign you if you work with Gene. that was one of the conditions. But we didn't mind, but, we didn't choose Gene. Gene was part of the deal. Whereas with Kevin and with Michael, we had choices in who we wanted to work with. So
what about the songs though? Were you pretty guarded about how the song should be arranged, or were you open to ideas?
Well, I was open to ideas. You know what? Certainly, writing songs with a partner is kind of like having a catch with someone. You throw the ball out, and they throw the ball back, and you throw the ball back, and they throw the ball back. And sometimes with producing, it's the same thing. You know, a lot of times, band members are they're too close to the music to be objective about it.
Mm.
And when you have an outside person, who is you know, not tainted by, you know, oh, it's my baby, I wrote this song, it's the most important song in the world, and don't change, you know, it's none of that, you know. It's a fresh idea. They offer ideas that you may not have thought of. Okay, so maybe this part is not the verse, it's the chorus or the pre-chorus, or maybe you go to halftime here, or maybe you extend this a little bit here, you know, or maybe there's a key change here that you hadn't thought of.
So how did those guys push you to get a performance out of you? Because I don't know whether you're a perfectionist in the studio where you just want to go back in and you don't feel it's right, and then they can go, no, we got it. Or would one of them maybe scream at you saying, no, that's not good enough, you gotta keep going? Was there all different ways that they approached that?
Yeah, well, I think in all three cases, all three producers, they all want what's best for you, and they all want their name is on the project too, you know. So yeah. they want it to be as good as possible. And again, sometimes when you're playing, you got your headphones on, you know, you're not hearing the little glitches that you're going to hear when they play it back and they solo the track. So, you know, I don't remember being like pissed off at anybody, you know, for wanting me to do something again. And I thought it was in my best interest that I have the best performance.
Okay. So, Mark, I just want to finish up with the, I just want to talk to you for a minute about the book that you did about 20-odd years ago, the Rockstar 101 book, The Guide to Survival and Success in the Music Business. What chapter or chapters would you add to that now? Because the business has changed so much.
It's changed tremendously. I wrote that manuscript in the year, might have been 2001. Okay, and so that book actually was released before a lot of the digital world exploded on us, you know. So that's the big change. Everything is digital now, and the way that music is produced and consumed has changed tremendously. There was no streaming back then, you know, and so that's really set the world up, you know, the music world upside down here, where people now are renting music as opposed to buying it, you know. Mm-hmm. So certainly that needs to be addressed. And there's just been some other, you know, Teutonic shifts in the music business in the last, book's been out 22 years now, so it definitely could use an updating.
When you released that book, was there many books like it at the time?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because there were no books like it at the time. And that's one reason why I wrote it, because there were, you know, there still are many books on the music business written by attorneys or agents or people, you know, or engineers or whatever, but none of them written by an actual recording artist, for a guy that started playing his garage and wound up playing Madison Square Garden, you know. And I wrote the book, you know, in a language that non-professionals, especially young upcoming musicians, can understand and relate to. Mm. And that's exactly why that book was the first of its kind. You know, I mean, obviously there's been a ton of autobiographies written by rockers, but no business books, you know.
Okay. Because
And by the way, it's funny, just this week I got a note on Facebook by someone who had the book and thanked me for writing it because it helped him so much. So nice. Here it is, 22 years later, that book is still resonating, and I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, because I've had David Ellison on, and he brought a book out. J.J. French has done a couple of books. I've interviewed him.
I read J.J.'s book is great, too.
Yeah.
So what's
happening with all these guys is, I think, I'm being very generalistic here, but they get into the business, they get screwed over. So then in order to continue, they have to find out the rest of the business, including the managing. And then they find out really what it's like and what they have to do. And then they bring out a book about it.
Well, that could be, you know, I know Dave very well. And I know JJ very well. And they're both extremely smart. You know, some of us are, you know, musicians who are businessmen, and some of them are businessmen who are musicians, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
So I think all three of us got a little combination of both of that.
Mm. So over the years, Mark, I just want to finish on this question. You would have been asked a lot of questions about the music business. So what do you think in general is the biggest misconception about the business out there that you have to correct people on more than anything else?
Oh, you know, it used to be that if you're signed to a major label, you're automatically a millionaire and everything is, you know, everything is done for you and you know, you're on easy street. You never have to work again. But that's the furthest thing from the truth, because once you get signed, your troubles just begin. You know, you're competing against many other bands. You're competing against, you know, genres that come in and out of favor. You know, you're competing against a lot of different things. So that's the big misconception, that just because you're on a major label, you're living in a mansion and you're living the high life. And I think, as I said earlier, it's just the furthest thing from the truth.
And did you find that you mentioned the lawyers bringing out the books and the record companies bringing out the books? Was that the one thing that they really didn't address in the books either?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, nobody wants to pull back the curtain and show the ugliness behind it, you know?
Yeah.
One of the things I mentioned in my book is that it's better to have no deal than to be in a bad deal, okay? Because a bad deal can really mess you up, you know? It's like getting your foot caught in a leg trap, you know? It's easy to get in that trap, but it's hard to get out, so...
Didn't you get caught in that leaving member clause?
Yes, that's exactly what happened with Cold Sweat, that yeah. They had a leaving member clause. I mean, in my case, I'm glad I was able to secure another major label deal right away. You know, I didn't have to go through that process of, you know, auditioning again.
Because in some cases, that can't work. You find out after the fact, and then they say, no, you're signed to the label and we have control, you can't go anywhere.
Well, in my case, it worked out okay.
Okay, good stuff. So, Mark, what's happening for the rest of the year, music-wise, Cold Sweat? You have shows coming up?
Well, we have a big one coming up in less than 4 weeks. We're playing the M3 Festival.
Yeah, that's right. Is that the only one you got?
Well, so far, I know we're being submitted for some other festivals, and we are actually announced on the 2025 Monsters of Rock Cruise, too. So we're real happy about that.
Nice. Well, Mark, do you want to tell everyone where they can get in touch with you and pick up a copy of the album?
Yeah, well, markferrari.com has a lot of information up on there, and the album is available, digitally. I know just where everybody goes to listen to music these days, whether it be Spotify or Amazon or whatever. So we're really happy to get these recordings out. You know, it's this great snapshot in time of what go back to 1991. This is kind of what was popular back then. So,
who had the live recordings?
Well, the Monsters of Rock was a board tape, and the Monsters of Rock Cruise, I should say, was a board tape, and the Monsters of Rock Festival was a cassette tape.
Wow!
I think Chris knows the history of that tape better than I do. But
okay.
It was a cassette, and that's why it sounds as rough as it does. But you know, we wanted to put it out just because it was the only live recording that we had the legal rights to.
And the four unreleased tracks, that's all you got. There was no more.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, that's a pity.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
All right, thank you so much.
All right, and have a good rest of the day.
All right. Awesome. Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. There you go. Richie's talk with Mark Ferrari. You want to hear more about what's going on with Mark? You can also go up to markferrari.com and check all that out. And I think next week or next episode.
Next year.
Yeah, next year. But I believe the next one up will be a discussion episode.
I think it will.
But yeah. So anyways, for this week, that's it. There ain't no more. Stick a fork in it. This puppy is done. So for myself and
Richie
and everybody else here at Focus on Metal, have yourselves a great metal week. And until we talk to you again next time, as always, remember,
Focus on Metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
It's over. Go home.